This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up on Playing with Food, cookbook author Bridget Binns.
You'll notice that there are some snails, some escargot on the cover, but there's one on the edge of the plate who's making its escape, and that's me. I'm the snail that's getting the hell out of Dodge.
Also, we'll hear from local author Terry Sanville about his writing and about his long career with the city of San Luis Obispo.
I think in 30 years, I never wrote a line of dialogue, you know, in a government report. And fiction is based on the interaction of people.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 22nd, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. A large housing development proposed for Napomo comes before county supervisors for a vote this week. The Dana Reserve Project has garnered support and opposition from community members. Here's KCBX's Beth Thornton.
In Napomo, not far off the 101 freeway, sits a 288-acre ranch surrounded by ancient oak trees. It's the proposed site of the Dana Reserve housing development. The plan to build about 1,400 units in this unincorporated community of San Luis Obispo County is contentious, exemplifying the struggle to balance the need for housing with concerns for the environment. The proposal is to build housing for all income levels, from very low to high. The master plan incorporates parks and trails, a child care center, and commercial buildings for restaurants and groceries. Nick Tompkins is a longtime Napomo resident. He's also the owner and managing partner of NKT Commercial, the company behind the project.
Spent a couple of years planning the project in terms of trying to find designs that would maximize the affordability of homes and provide the minimum impact on trees and still be financially viable to be able to pay for the significant infrastructure that's required.
He says community outreach has been an ongoing part of the process.
There are actually a surprising number of supporters that have come along and helped throughout this project. And there's also some people that are actively opposed to it.
Large regional employers like Dignity Health and housing advocates like People's Self-Help Housing have spoken in support of the plan. SLO County, like most of California, is in a housing crisis. Central Coast employers say they can't recruit staff because there's no place for them to live. And Tompkins says the county is especially behind in building units in the category of very low income.
The county of San Luis Obispo has only generated 7 very low income homes over the last 5 years. This project is generating 102.
This project would be one of the county's most ambitious developments in years, with very low income and low income units, workforce housing, age-restricted units, ADUs, and a range of moderate to high income homes. It checks a lot of boxes. Much of the opposition to the project is due to the removal of ancient oak trees to make way for houses. Of the 17,000 oak trees on or near the site, about 3,000 will be lost to development. Tompkins says he'll put a permanent conservation easement in place to protect the remaining 14,000 oaks on Dana Ridge. And as part of the mitigation process, new trees will be planted throughout the development. But locals say it's not as simple as replacing an old tree with a new one. It takes many, many years for an oak to mature. And the existing trees hold historical and cultural significance for Napomo. Local youth activist Cesar Vasquez is joining with other students from the Central Coast Student Coalition to advocate for the land. He says preserving the ancient trees for future generations should be a top priority.
If they can destroy the 3,000 trees here, they can do it anywhere. And eventually, if this continues on, there's not even going to be 3,000 trees to cut down.
Vasquez says the project's objective, to provide affordable options for Central Coast families, isn't realistic. He thinks the home prices are too high.
Obviously, SLO has a housing crisis, but this isn't helping people of SLO. This is helping the people who are going to be coming from LA.
He says prolonged construction will impact air quality and damage local habitats.
There's three different ways to look at the detrimental effects of this. There's the housing, the affordability of the housing. There is the health of people, and then there's the health of the land.
The Student Coalition, per their website, supports a community-generated alternative housing plan that reduces impacts to the trees and surrounding area. The County of San Luis Obispo makes decisions about housing. Last October, the Planning Commission approved the Dana Reserve Master Plan with some recommendations. And now it's up to the Board of Supervisors. KCBX contacted the office of County Supervisor Jimmy Paulding, whose district includes Napomo, and we're told he's not making any comments until after the vote. The meeting is Tuesday and Wednesday in downtown SLO. More information is on the county website. For KCBX News, I'm Beth Thornton.
This is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangerman. Up next, playing with food.
Hello. Hi, are you Bridget?
I am. Are you Father Ian?
I am. Thank you for having me here.
Well, it's very nice to meet you.
Welcome to Playing with Food on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, taking you on an exploration of the foods of the Central Coast. Someone who knows a lot about playing with food is a recipe creator and cookbook author. Accomplished cookbook author for Williams-Sonoma and other publishers, Bridget Binns lives right here on the Central Coast. After a career of writing recipes, she has now written a memoir of growing up in Hollywood as a daughter of actor Ed Binns. Bridget invited me into her kitchen to cook, chat, and eat. My favorite pastime. This is how it went.
My name is Bridget Binns, and I have written a whole lot of cookbooks. But recently, I decided to write a memoir. It's called Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival.
You are a cookbook writer, and you're going to cook today, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to cook?
Given your scope, your brief to me, which was completely wide open, I thought I better do cheese souffle, because it was basically the first thing that my mother taught me how to cook. She and I did not have a great relationship, which is a lot of what the book is about, not all of what the book is about. And you can see here my Julia Child cookbook that I've had for many, many, many years.
Wow.
And look how it's open to the page with the cheese souffle that has been taped up. I mean, this is
The binding is broken at this cheese souffle.
Yes.
The pages are all yellowed.
Mm-hmm.
You've got things highlighted in there.
It's been used and loved for a long time. I don't actually follow recipe for cheese souffle anymore because I know it so well. But I thought for today with you that I would go back to the original and actually follow it.
That's really interesting thing about books. When we get new books, we're very careful with them. We don't want to bend the binding. We want it to look brand new all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then 20, 30, 40 years later, we cherish the usedness of the books.
Isn't that, that's so funny. That's hilarious. And I mean, this thing has been with me from Oregon to New York to England to Spain, back to California, back to New York, back to California again. So it deserves to look a little lived in.
Yeah. It's great. It's great.
And absolutely. Here, actually, from sixth grade, is my very first cookbook. Little index cards with a ring binder with my funky little crabby writing with the abbreviations. And there's a scrambled egg recipe.
Ambrosia.
Yes, something that should never be eaten ever by anyone.
Where's the jello?
There is no jello in this one. It's
just that's not true ambrosia.
you're absolutely right. Coconut, banana, oranges. Yeah. Where's the jello?
Did you know you wanted to be a cookbook writer cook or a chef
no.
at that age?
No. So I think this was home ec, but it says something in here about home economics. Oh, homemaking
A.
That clearly is a school project that I was assigned, but no, I had no idea at that point that I would ever. I didn't have any idea for ages. I mean, I majored in Chinese studies in college. I certainly didn't set out to become a cookbook author. So that was just an early iteration.
Okay, well, should I let you get started?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the first things that I'm going to do is the egg whites. And the egg whites have to get lofty. They have to get big.
the trick to getting a lofty effect on your egg whites is to beat them in a copper bowl, because there's a chemical reaction that happens between copper and the albumin in the egg whites that causes them to get even bigger. Now,
so you got your cheese here.
Yes, and I'm using Gruyere, which is the traditional way. Now, sometimes when I make souffles, I do it with a white cheddar or a manchego. I like to break those rules a little bit, but I thought since we're going with Julia, we are going to follow her rules. And Gruyere is the original French way to do it. I often put spinach, diced ham. There's all kinds of fun things you can do with souffle. And then there's also a souffled omelet. When I did the breakfast book for Williams-Sonoma, I learned about those. It's kind of like an omelet, but much fluffier.
You create recipes. What's involved in creating a recipe in order to write a cookbook?
I always say that there aren't really any brand new recipes, and if there were, we probably wouldn't like them. Nobody needs to create rabbit with raspberries. Just because it sounds like nice doesn't mean it's going to taste good. So what there are variations on existing recipes, and that's where the talent comes in. When I was working for Williams-Sonoma, I did 11 books for them. They have a stable of the most amazingly smart and switched on editors. And a lot of times they would give me a recipe list, titles only. So then we would noodle them together and figure out, you know, what do we want? Is this a nice balance, et cetera? And then I would go out and develop the recipes. And developing the recipes means looking at everything I have written before to see if, did I learn something previously that will be helpful here? Or did I have something in a restaurant that reminds me of this? So it's putting things together, and what I do is, so just quickly, I'm scalding the milk. If I step away from it, it will boil over, guaranteed. So this is something where you just have to pay attention. But meanwhile, I'm gonna start melting the butter. So being that there's no new recipes, basically I'm writing it out of my brain, and then I test it. I test it as many times as it needs to be tested. But the important thing is to write what I think is going to happen, just to give me somewhere to start. For my very first book, which was Polenta, 40 recipes using polenta. Now, there weren't enough recipes to make it a fully rounded book without going to some other cultures besides just Italian. And so I used some recipes from the American South that officially weren't really polenta, but Great. They were... Yes, like grits. I think there's a souffle. There's some breakfast polenta from Eastern Europe. There's all kinds of cultures that use coarse cornmeal, including South Africa. There's a thing called, I think it's bobotti, that has cornmeal in it. So I'm just looking everywhere.
You're listening to Playing with Food on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian in the kitchen of cookbook writer come memoir writer Bridget Binns. We've been chatting about her cookbook career while she makes Julia Child's classic cheese souffle, and now she's about to tell us how it all got started.
When I got back from Spain after 10 years in Europe, 7 in England and then 3 in southern Spain, I needed a job, so I tried to work at a little bookstore near the Beverly Center in LA called the Cook's Library, and I worked there for 2 weeks, and she said, you're totally overqualified. You need to get a much better job than this. And she said, you know what? There's a polenta book out there waiting to be written. Ellen Rose, she would have liked to write it herself, but just didn't have time. So she told me the name of an editor at Chronicle Books that might be interested, and that's how I got that gig, and that was my first book, and it was just life-changing. It was truly wonderful. Okay, so now I have a roux. A roux is a mixture of butter and flour. I don't want it to color. If we were making something from New Orleans, we would be cooking it for 45 minutes until it was mahogany brown.
I did that on National Gumbo Day. It took me forever. Oh, you're going to put the milk in.
I am, and I'm using my wooden whisk. I start with the whisk until I get it amalgamated.
It's beautiful.
It's nice and pale.
I never scald my milk when I do a roux. Are you supposed to?
You are supposed to.
Oh, okay. I just put cold milk in.
Well, if you're going to do cold milk, you're supposed to take it off the heat. Okay. You have two choices, and I actually did both.
So going back to creating these recipes, mm-hmm. So you just iteration after iteration and mm-hmm. think about what goes in there. How do you know what you don't know in terms of that one secret ingredient, whether it's a squeeze of lime, a drop of fish sauce or something like that? How do you know what you don't know that's going to make that dish pop?
When you taste it, you know.
what's usually missing in almost all cases, I love that you mentioned fish sauce, is acidity. Especially with rich food, you need a pop of acidity to balance down the richness. A Greek chef that I worked for at one point said he could look in the dining room and tell when people had had too much richness, and then he knew that he needed to put a little bit more vinegar or lemon juice or whatever to pop up that brightness. But you have to taste as you go along. You know, the experience that I've had, I can get fairly close on the written recipe just because I've just done enough. I'm going to start putting my egg yolks in one at a time. So one at a time, because guess what? This is really hot and we don't want the egg yolk to scramble. But so now that I have the first yolk in there and it didn't scramble, then it's safe to go a little faster.
You've created your recipe, mm-hmm. and it's for a cookbook. And how do you get those pictures?
In general, most of the time, I have nothing to do with the photography.
Somebody else cooks the dish and takes the pictures?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
The publisher takes care of all of that. If I'm really lucky, I can recommend somebody that I like to work with, like on my book, The Relaxed Kitchen. My friend Christina Schmidhofer, who is a photographer for Williams Sonoma catalogs and various other catalogs and all kinds of wonderful things. I was able to get her as the photographer for the Relaxed Kitchen, and it was really fun to work with her. But in general, I have no say whatsoever. For the publisher, that's another opportunity to test the recipe and make sure that it's right. Okay, so I have this as our sauce base. I just need my seasonings, which is paprika, white pepper, and salt, and get those in there. Now I'm going to do the egg whites, which is going to be rather noisy. All we have is a perfectly clean copper bowl and 5 egg whites. I am going to put a pinch of salt in there because that will help give us some lift. And it's going to take a couple of minutes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
So what we're going to do now, this is kind of a delicate operation. We have to start with about a quarter of the egg white mixture into our sauce base. Because if I try to just dump this in there, I would end up crushing all the air out of my egg whites. This will loosen it up to the point where it can get happy and friendly with the egg whites. Folding and cutting through the center. Okay, so we got to go in the oven right away.
How long does it have to be in there?
Well, we'll see.
Does this mean we get a chance to talk about your book?
Yes, we do.
Okay. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and I'm Father Ian, playing with food with cookbook writer Bridget Binns. She just popped a souffle into the oven, having followed Julia Child's classic recipe to a T. And now we're going to chat about her new memoir about growing up in Hollywood, Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival. So your book, how did it get its name?
My mother called me Rotten Kid from the time I was about 13 up until her deathbed. Sometimes a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but she also told all of her friends that I was the Rotten Kid, the bad seed. And I was never expected to succeed at anything because I was too selfish, self-involved, trite, superficial. And so that was what I grew up with, was that expectation that I was rotten and that I had disappointed my mother desperately. And it took me a long time to climb out of that. I think it's really hard for kids who are not given unconditional love to find a way to emotional stability and to find some self-esteem. And one of the reasons I went to England was to get as far away as possible from my mother. My father was an actor. I grew up in Hollywood, and he was a wonderful man, but just not really qualified to be a parent. And he was absent quite a lot of the time. And by the time I was 16, going off to my second boarding school, he had gone completely. He had abandoned me and left me there with her. And so that's why it's called Rotten Kid. If you see the cover, you'll notice that there are some snails, some escargot on the cover. But there's one on the edge of the plate who's making its escape, and that's me. I'm the snail that's getting the hell out of Dodge.
Oh, yes. There's a snail escaping.
There's the snail getting out of Dodge.
At the end of the book, there are recipes.
There's only 4. Some people wanted me to put more in there, but it's not a cookbook. The recipes are not really the kind of things that you necessarily would cook. Normal people.
I mean, one of them is called Weenie and Egg, because that's what my dad used to cook for me for breakfast. My mother never got up until noon. Every morning he would say, what do you want for breakfast? And I would say, Weenie and Egg. So it's basically you cut up a hot dog and boil it, and then you soft boil an egg, and then you scoop them all together and put a little butter, and that's Weenie and Egg. So there's a recipe for that.
I saw that, and I was like, and then I went and found the reference and noticed that it's there because it's part of your story. It's not a cookbook. This is a part of your life story.
It really is. And I'm actually, next week, I'm going to go down to LA and record the audiobook. They've hired me as the narrator for the audiobook. And I saw on the script that I just got yesterday that they have all the recipes in there. And I said, do you really want me to read the recipes out loud? And they said, yes, we actually do, because we want the audiobook to be as close as possible to the printed book. So that'll be fun.
Back to the book. Mr. Beef is interesting because it also tells the story of periods of your life, of how Mr. Beef changed depending on where you lived. Mm. I don't know what Mr. Beef actually is.
Well, Mr. Beef changes with time. The first Mr. Beef was a standing rib roast, i.e. what we think of as prime rib in this country. Very, very expensive cut. When I was married to the investment banker and I lived in a little village in Hampshire, and the butcher would cut it off of the bones and then tie it back on, so that made it very easy to carve. Very beautiful, very expensive. The second Mr. Beef was after the investment banker lost his job, lost his nerve, completely lost his mojo, and we had to hightail it down to Spain in a big truck with all of our worldly possessions, and instantly we became not as wealthy. Not wealthy in any way. So the second Mr. Beef was a brisket that was simmered in red wine for a long time and became absolutely fall apart gorgeous, but was not expensive in any way. And then the third Mr. Beef was a boneless ribeye roast on the rotisserie over hardwood charcoal that was poked with anchovies and rosemary and turned on the spit until it gets this amazing crispy crust on the outside and very delicious. At the last minute, gets that secret crust building treatment, which is you brush the whole outside with a little melted butter only at the very end, and then sprinkle it with Wondra flour. And so it develops this amazing golden shattery crust on the outside. So those are our three versions of Mr. Beef.
And how did Mr. Beef get his name?
I like to name things. Let's have Mr. Beef for Christmas or some other fabulous occasion. You know, you're making me think now. My mother liked to name things as well. And I generally try to shy away from doing things the way she did. But I guess the apple fell a little too close to the tree.
This is Father Ian, and I'm in the kitchen of Bridget Binns on Playing with Food, a part of KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Bridget just shared how the very few recipes in her memoir help tell the story of her life rather than provide the reader with dinner party ideas. And now she is going to share how the book came into being.
How difficult was it to write this book? Was it cathartic, or was it just you needed to get the words on the page, or was it something else?
I knew I wanted to write it a long time ago. I didn't know what it was going to be, but I knew I wanted to write something about my childhood and my mother. In 2009, I went to Marfa, Texas for a month, and I thought, because Marfa is so full of talented artists, that maybe some of that talent would land on me. But my bungalow had a heater that was making these clanking noises, and I decided that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was going to happen in my bungalow, and so I got absolutely nothing done for the whole month. At the end of the month, I put all my index cards and my How to Write a Memoir books into a plastic box, and I carried them around for 10 years until the pandemic. I knew that I couldn't publish this book when my mother was still alive. Also, there's the whole issue of the governor. My mother had a 25-year affair with Governor Edmund G. Brown, Pat Brown, who is the father of Jerry Brown. And I knew that it would not be kind to publish the book while he was still California's governor. So those are things that contributed to the fact that I didn't get it done, but also I wasn't ready. When pandemic happened, I was forced to sit there and say, how can I be productive? Okay, maybe I should write this book now. That's how it finally happened. Was it cathartic? Yes and no. I mean, the work that I did that allowed me to transcend her disapproval and disappointment in me happened in therapy quite some time ago when I first got back from Europe. But reminding myself of the very painful breakup of my first marriage by writing about it, it was painful. It was not fun to revisit that time, but it was stuff that had to come out. You know, it wanted to be written.
Now that it's written, are you able to read it?
Well, I'm about to read it out loud. So I guess, so.
And then we couldn't resist the smell of the souffle.
It looks
beautiful and it smells beautiful. Can we go look?
We
can't open the oven though.
We cannot yet. We gotta get our plates ready because souffle waits for no man. I'm gonna jiggle it.
You're gonna jiggle it?
Yeah. And it's
look
ready.
At that crust.
Isn't that pretty?
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's coming out.
It's gonna go down very rapidly. So what I wanna do is serve it quick.
Oh my gosh.
If I did a nice coating of the cheese, we will get this golden thing on the edges, see?
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You are gonna get a nice little scooping of goldenness. Look at that happy bit there.
Wow.
Whoopsie.
It was time to dine together.
Of edge.
So let me know when I can try it.
You can try it right now.
Try it right now?
Of course. Yeah.
Here we go.
Because we don't want it to fall. And that's the result of all that whipping.
It's delicious. It's absolutely delicious.
Mm. Wow. It's good, huh?
With this recipe mm-hmm. in the book being so weathered, do you still make it?
Yes, I do make it a lot.
My souffles have never had this crust on the outside. Mm. I obviously don't do the cheese well enough.
You gotta be generous with the cheese on it. Generous with the buttering of the dish and generous with the cheese coating. And then you dump out the excess cheese so that there's not too much, but there's enough. That's why we have those nice edges.
Caramelized cheese,
mm-hmm.
delicious.
What could be wrong with that?
I know. Why do you think it's so difficult to grow up in Hollywood? Because your story, bits and pieces of it, are replicated in the stories of a lot of Hollywood kids.
Because it's not about kids. The town is not about kids. It's about what is necessary for the grown-ups to do to further their careers. And there's just a general selfishness, I think, that exists in that business. Your identity, your pleasure, yourself is more important. There are always going to be those over-the-top birthday parties and people paying lip service to the idea of being good parents. But in reality, for me anyway, I was more like an accessory for my parents.
There's a picture of you, a wonderful picture of you with your mom and your dad when you were three on the cover of the TV Guide, salting a steak. And you say that all that glitters is not gold. And that picture certainly portrays the glamour of Hollywood. But are there still wonderful familial moments for Hollywood families?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They're not necessarily normal when compared to other people's familial moments, but they can be truly wonderful. I mean, I met Fred Astaire when I was about 12, and to be in the presence of that classic old Hollywood royalty, that was quite something. So there were some great times. On the balance of that also, on the other side of that, is he did an episode of Hawaii Five-O one time, and my mother and I were invited to come over at the end to spend a couple of days in Honolulu after he was finished. After that was over, they went back first class, and they put me on standby. I was 12, and I didn't get on the plane. So they flew off, and I'm sitting there alone in the Honolulu airport reading A Wrinkle in Time for 6 hours until I could get onto another flight. And I thought, you know, is this normal? There were definitely fun times. And my dad was a larger than life figure, especially when he was still drinking. He was quite the life of the party.
Then it was time for the surprise. I probably have done the riskiest thing I've ever done in my playing with food career.
Mm-hmm.
I've done something one should never, ever, ever, ever do.
Okay. But you felt that it was wise.
No, that's not part of that. Wisdom is not part of this.
Wisdom took holiday.
Risk. risk, I guess. One should never cook a recipe of a chef and bring it to her. But I did.
Uh-oh. Did it work?
I don't know. I want you to tell me if you're willing to, if you're that brave.
I'll try anything.
So, I made your lemon pudding cake.
Okay. How fun.
I hope it meets you.
Oh, it smells so good.
What do you think?
I love it. I think it's really good.
With that, we'll end on a high note, affirmed by an accomplished chef and cookbook writer. Every person has an interesting story, and often those stories involve food. Lucky me, Bridget shared herself with me through her food, both in her memoir and in her kitchen. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman. A former City of San Luis Obispo employee went from writing government documents to essays and novels. I recently sat down to catch up with author Terry Sanville. Terry, welcome to Issues and Ideas.
Thank you, Carol. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you here.
Thanks.
So let's just go through a quick rundown of your history.
A quick rundown. I was born and raised in Santa Barbara, came to Cal Poly in 1965 and studied architecture for a couple of years, and architecture and myself didn't agree. So I took a little do loop through the military and spent a year in Vietnam, came back, got a degree in city and regional planning, and worked for San Luis Obispo for 30 years. Doing mostly what was called advanced planning as opposed to permit processing. That got me into writing, although a very different style of writing, you know, technical stuff.
Different than writing a novel or any other creative endeavor.
Everything you want to do in a governmental technical report, you do the opposite in fiction.
Now, I remember back, and this is when you were at the city. And it's funny because today, of course, their traffic management is everywhere on the streets of San Luis Obispo. But it was about 1995, and I was living on Choro Street at the time.
I remember it well.
And there was a lot of traffic, heavy traffic. We wanted to, you know, slow it down. Then you came into the picture to develop a plan.
Right.
Traffic, we called it traffic calming at the time.
Right, exactly. Now we call it traffic management. Everybody involved isn't necessarily calm. But Choro Street was on the bleeding edge of traffic management and traffic calming in San Luis Obispo. And because it was on the bleeding edge, it became very controversial. It started out as a great example of participatory democracy. The neighborhood came forward.
We had meetings.
You know, we had meetings. You know, things were going great. And, you know, 6 months later, it was, what the heck were you thinking?
Right, once everything went in.
Yeah, all the folks who use the street as a throughway, and even some people in the neighborhood, objected to it. A lot of controversy. We actually held the final meeting at the Veterans Hall here in San Luis, and we had over 400 people show up.
Oh, that... That
was a memorable night.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I still have... I won't call them nightmares, but they're dreams.
Yeah. A lot of people in the neighborhood felt that way, too.
Yeah, they were helped at the beginning, and then, you know, it turned south. So,
The city council, I think, didn't realize maybe how controversial the plan was. And now, of course, We could have a conversation right now about bulb outs and roundabouts and designated bike lanes, and everyone, you know, knows exactly what that is. At that time,
it was...
The speed humps.
Yeah, all new stuff.
Yeah, this was the mid-90s, so...
Yeah, people in the North City wanted to continue to use the routes that they used. They didn't want to be encouraged to go elsewhere outside the neighborhood. And they didn't like, you know, circles. So.
I get it. So the roundabouts, traffic circle went in.
Right.
Speed humps. And then the city took them all out.
Yep.
But I think we ended up with the stop signs.
We ended up with the stop signs. An old saying in urban planning is make no small plans. We could have started with the stop signs, but it probably would have ended there. So we sort of backed into our current situation, and it's changing again with the bike way.
What do you think of that? The Choro Street has designated bike lanes that are separated by
the curbing.
The little curbing.
Yeah. they have their pluses and minuses. There is not a traffic management element that doesn't have pluses and minuses. The pluses are that protected bikeways is that people feel more comfortable riding in them, especially people who are not seasoned bicyclists. You know, mothers with children may feel more comfortable in something that has a little bit of firm protection between them and adjoining traffic. On the other hand, you might lose parking along your street. And in old neighborhoods, parking can be at a premium.
Especially with rentals near Cal Poly.
Exactly. There's lots of cars in a single house, and you can only put so many in the driveway because the garage is probably an apartment.
Right. You don't want to block anyone else in. It's the whole thing.
So all of it has, you know, pluses and minuses. In general, I like what's being done. I think it improves safety, and it's heartening for me because when I was involved with traffic management and bicycle programs, they didn't have the support of the councils and they didn't have the support of the community that is now there. That means a whole heck of a lot. Of course, everything the city's doing now, I'm sure there's detractors out there and it's also controversial, but I was especially surprised to see through bikeways through the downtown. I never thought that would happen. Removing lanes and taking parking out was sort of anathema. So all good stuff.
All good stuff. On to the next chapter of your life, writing. So you had to go from writing government documents and such to writing fiction. What was that process like?
Well, it took a couple years. A good government report had to be well-organized, comprehensive, clear, accurate, and it avoided tension. It avoided controversy as much as possible. It avoided personalities.
Right. Your voice was not
supposed to be there. Invisible narrator in the background. I think in 30 years, I never wrote a line of dialogue, you know, in a government report. And fiction is based on the interaction of people.
Yeah.
Their characters, their situations, and the trials and tribulations that they go through. Even in fanciful situations like science fiction or fantasy or horror or some of the other genres, it's the characters and the setting and the tension and conflict that draws people into a piece of fiction. And that's what every writer wants to do.
Well, I think you did a good job with that with your latest book, The Misplaced. I enjoyed that. We'll get back to that in just a minute.
Okay.
Generally, have you been writing about your own experiences or what motivated you?
I'll preach a little bit here for 30 seconds. novice writers tend to write what they know. Okay. And so what do you know? You know yourself, hopefully, and you know your history. And so novice writers often pull stories out of their own history. And that's sort of a natural progression, I think. But as you continue to work, you realize that, you know, my life just isn't that interesting. and you have to take those personal anecdotes and create stories from them that go above and beyond what you experienced. I have used many, many personal anecdotes as a story seed to write a story around it. Sometimes creating new characters, new endings, new outcomes, new tensions. The second stage, I think, of writing for many people is write what you can learn.
Hmm.
You know, I've written a story about the slave trade in the 16th century on an island off the east coast of Africa.
Have you ever been there?
I've never been there. I've never been a slave. And there's a whole thing of cultural appropriation, an issue that is with us these days.
Yeah.
But you can learn about situations and create stories that you couldn't possibly have experienced personally as a writer. So writing what you can learn is sort of a second stage. And I think the third stage is writing what you can imagine. And that combines all three of these things.
What have you written that falls under that category for you, something you imagined?
Well, in 2021, not a good time to be publishing, I have a collection of short stories still available from Main Street Rag Press, and it's titled The Last Time You Were Here. And these are all stories that would be classified as magical realism. Think Twilight Zone on steroids. They have a magical element to them, but the basic elements are realistic. And those are fun. Those are fun to write because you can sort of sit back and transitioning from reality to some other state is always a fun challenge for writers.
Yeah. Yeah, because that comes from your imagination.
Yeah, that's right.
No one can duplicate that.
I hope not. I'm not sure who would want to.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman, and with me is author Terry Sanville. His latest novel is The Misplaced. Well, I would say that The Misplaced, to me, felt so real.
Yes.
And you're writing, you know, the voice, it's first person, a young girl. And
yeah.
I will say that even though the young girl, Margaret, she was born much before I was, there were a lot of things that you wrote about in her childhood
right.
that I related to.
Yeah. I think in my writing, I tried to, with each and every piece, I try to challenge myself. It's easy to write from a male perspective, but after a while, you realize that you can't get beyond your own perspective. Some writers claim you never can, but I think writing from a female perspective, a female child's perspective, was interesting. And, you know, I have to admit that my wife, Marguerite Costigan, helped with that. Because she did grow up in rural Pennsylvania. A quick synopsis. The Misplaced is a story about a family as told through the eyes of the oldest daughter, Margaret. And the family starts out as a very urban family. They have a house on Long Island, New York. The father's a commercial artist and works in New York City. But he has a nervous breakdown. We would call it a psychotic break these days. And he has mental health issues. We would call it these days bipolar 1 disorder. But this is 1951. So the psychiatrist at Bellevue Hospital in New York tell them that you need to move out in New York City. You need to move into a rural, quiet, pastoral setting to reduce the overall stress of life. And so they do that. And they moved to this rural farm in Pennsylvania, right in smack dab in the middle of Pennsylvania Dutch country, which is 1951, is conservative, it's agricultural based, it's small villages and towns. And so now this family is living in this big old ramshackle farmhouse, which needs a lot of work. They're very urban. The father listens to opera every day,
and they don't use their land, right?
Right, they don't use their land, and that's a mortal sin when it comes to the Pennsylvania Dutch at the time, that they let the land go fallow because they're not even gentlemen farmers. They're the interlopers. They're the misplaced people in this culture. So,
and that's hard on a kid, you know, when the daughter has to go to school with the local kids.
Yeah, three different grades in one room. They didn't value education, the arts, or intellectual pursuits as much as protagonist family. The smart outcast kid is what Margaret ended up being with few friends.
But some of her experiences seemed so universal. Standing up, facing the corner, the flag in the corner, and some kid has a hard time saying...
indivisible.
And then the teacher toots on her little pitch pipe.
Right.
I mean, that just took me back. And the mom would wait two rings before they pick up the telephone. We always did that. Yeah. Where did you come up with some of those details?
Well, even in urban areas, I grew up in Santa Barbara, we were on a party line.
I always thought that was so you didn't appear too eager
right.
whoever's calling.
Yeah.
I'm not sitting waiting by the phone for your call. And there were a lot of different aspects of it that I think spoke to a childhood of that era.
Yeah, 50s was an interesting time.
For everyone. Yeah. And I think, too, the perspective of the young girl, Margaret, the way she looked at her parents seemed really familiar to me, too. Was that hard to get in the head of a child? Her perspective of it that also felt, it felt real.
Yeah. I used a tried and true strategy for the child becoming part of the parent's situation, and that is eavesdropping. This child was always listening in on her parents, and in the very beginning, she really didn't understand what was going on, but the reader of the book understands because the eavesdropping conversations are presented. And so we go, oh, yeah, this is what's going on. But the child is going, well, what is lithium salts? And how do you spell psychiatrist? Mm-hmm. You know, so the tricky part for writing from a child's perspective is you can't have the child act as an adult. You can't have them realize things that an adult would realize, but you can have them observe them and report that observation in the text. And in that way, the reader understands more than the character does.
Mm, yeah.
You know? But it's always a challenge because you want to write, you know, as if the child understands adult situations. And you have to stay away from that until that child grows into their teens, becomes a young adult, and starts to realize the connections that adults make.
Okay, Terry, can you read a paragraph from The Misplaced?
Sure. This is taken from chapter 2. It's the first paragraph, and it presents the situation this family is in. On a warm spring evening in Port Washington on Long Island, Daddy came home from work in New York City. He flung open our front door so hard that the knob slammed into the wall and made a hole. He looked scared, and his body shook. He stared open-mouthed at Carolyn and me on the sofa, then grabbed a bottle off the sideboard, ran down the hall, and ducked into the bathroom. Mama came out of the kitchen, her face wet from cooking over the stove. "Charles, are you all right, Charles?" From down the hall came the sound of things being smashed. Mama edged toward the bathroom and tapped on the door. "Honey, why don't you come out? I'll fix you a martini the way you like it. We can talk." He answered, but I couldn't understand. His voice, something between a scream and a laugh.
Have you known...
Have I known people with bipolar disorder and have gone through a psychotic break? Yes, I have.
Okay.
And they are challenging to live with. But families sort of learn to, you know, deal with those things. And in the rural setting that the novel takes place, that is a real challenge because the father is home most of the time working, unless he's down at the tavern watching the fights. But it is a challenge. And I do have a number of people that I sort of borrowed my experience with them to try to be real about the father's actions and responses.
Yeah. So when you were writing The Misplaced and when you're also writing some of your other short stories, mm-hmm. and you've written another novel or two before this, do you have other writers that you gather with?
Absolutely. Everything I write goes through a three-step editing process. The first editor is my in-house editor, my wife, who learned all those funny rules of English, which I shined on as a kid. And she's an excellent copy editor, and she's a good story editor, too. That's step one. Step two, I belong to a critique group, and there's a number of critique groups in San Luis Obispo County. There's an organization called the San Luis Obispo Night Writers, Slow Night, WRITERS.org. And they have about, I think, 175 members. They meet once a month, and they talk about craft issues, and they talk a lot about marketing issues, how to, you know, and how to get published. So they, both my wife and the Night Writers were of help, and the critique group. Our critique group meets twice a month for a couple hours. We share each other's work and provide constructive criticism. And over time, we've learned to take the praise with the criticism. It's something that you will never get from a publisher. when a publisher looks at a story or a novel, it's usually either simply a thumbs up or thumbs down decision for them. They're not going to say, well, if you just would do this or suggest editing, they either accept it or reject it simply because they get thousands of submissions and they don't have time to pay extra attention to a particular piece. What publishers often tell writers, and it's a often repeated comment, is that they want people to submit writing that's about something new,
yeah,
or writing that's about something common presented in a unique and new way.
Okay.
There's another organization, by the way, I want to plug. It's the Coastal Dune branch of the California Writers Club. And they hold the monthly meetings in Napomo at the Napomo Library. They have a website, too, so you can Google both those groups, Night Writers and the Coastal Dunes folks. And they're always looking for members. So
good.
And they're really helpful.
Good. For anyone else who's decided they want to go from the workaday world to do some writing.
I would say this, that probably 90% of what I write is short fiction, short stories. The reason why I like writing them is because, A, they're short, and B, I can change topics, themes, characters frequently to address the multitude of things I'm interested in or interest me. But you won't make any money writing short fiction, period. Right. It's not like the good old John Updike days where he could write for The New Yorker.
For a magazine, yeah, and The Atlantic.
Write for The Atlantic and make some bucks. The good news is that there's hundreds, probably thousands of journals, magazines, and anthologies being published. So the market is very broad. My theory is that if the writing is good, you can find a home for your story.
Well, thank you, Terry Sanville, and his latest novel, The Misplaced. And it says on the front, I love this, big cities can drive you crazy, but pastoral countryside can create its own kind of insanity. And so where can people find your book?
It's available on Amazon in both paperback and Kindle form. It's available on Barnes & Noble. It's also listed on Goodreads, on Apple, on Google Books. So if you just Google the title and my name, Terry Sanville,
you'll get it.
You'll get the whole list, yeah.
All right. Thank you for joining me.
It was my pleasure, Carol.
Terry Sanville, author of The Misplaced and other works. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Amidst the bustling streets of Salinas, a cultural oasis exists where the spirit of Mexico comes alive. Alyssa Toledo reports from a community center where local dancers are preparing to perform folklorico, a traditional Mexican folk dance.
Bueno, todos, everybody who's dancing calabacio después on the stage.
At the Alisal Center for the Fine Arts, or ACFA, the vibrant rhythms of baile folklorico echo through its halls. Alfredo Avila is the interim executive director at ACFA. He says the class serves as a testament to the rich Mexican culture that's woven into the fabric of the city.
Some of our dancers, their families are from Jalisco. So it's not just a dance, you know, for the sake of recreation, but literally carrying on, you know, culture that's important to them, that's in their home.
Okay, if you're in the front, we finish on four, they finish on eight, you guys know what I'm talking about, right?
As the dancers take the stage for their final rehearsal, Avila says they carry with them the stories of their ancestors, each step a tribute to the spirit of Mexican identity in Salinas. According to the U.S. Census, about 80% of people who live in the city are Latino, and more than 70% speak a language other than English at home.
We're all about tapping into the roots, and we're also about pushing the culture forward as a way to connect with other folks.
Jesus Angel Diaz is a longtime student of the folklorico classes. Now, he's a lead instructor at the center. He says when people think of folklorico, they typically think of the colorful attire associated with the dance. But as his beginner and advanced classes rehearse for their upcoming performances across Monterey County, it's clear that it's so much more.
So, one, two, three, four, five.
It brings in all the traditional dances from each different region, each different state in Mexico. And even within each state, there's so much to be discovered. There's so much different outfits, so much different dance styles, and so much different influences from everywhere around the world.
Diaz acknowledges that the youth attending the center come from diverse socioeconomic backgrounds. He says the classes provide a safe environment for local children.
Acosta Plaza here, this is the street that I grew up on. It was kind of a gang-related or dangerous environment that we grew up in. And I know some of the kids come from that same environment. So we kind of create this safe place for them.
Remember, when we're walking out, we never want to just turn around and the audience is my back. We want to walk out kind of backwards when we're looking at the audience. Thank you, muchas gracias, they see our face.
Luna Ruiz Laura and Ariana Suelar are beginner students at ACFA. They've dedicated over a year to learning folklorico. Both express their involvement in the class has deepened their connection to the Latino heritage.
I mean, when I was little, I went to go to Mexico and I saw this performance and I really liked it. And at home, I just started dancing. And then my mom decided to sign me up and so I came and I really liked it.
As Ruiz Laura reflects on her nerves for their upcoming shows, Suelar reminds us what participating in this dance means to her.
My grandma really likes the dance, the type of dance. Makes me feel more connected to her.
Alfredo Avila hopes to go beyond engaging the youth. He says they're also trying to involve parents. Avila envisions transforming the center into a, quote, one-stop shop, where parents can participate in classes alongside their children.
And it's not like leaving the kids at daycare, finding a place. It's like, no, we're all gonna participate. And then when the shows come, the whole family can perform.
Avila says Baile Folklorico isn't just about movement. It's a living, breathing expression of history, resilience, and community. Although the advanced class is presently at full capacity due to a shortage of instructors, Avila is actively encouraging new students to enroll in their beginner class. He says the dance classes allow the personalities and style of each child to grow.
And it's very apparent in the advanced group, but in the beginner group, it's super dope to see that growth in just a few weeks, you know?
Avila wants to expand the ACFA Folklorico program by nurturing more instructors from their advanced group. He also hopes to organize more community events to strengthen the organization's presence throughout the Salinas community. More information about ACFA's upcoming performances for Baile Folklorico are on the Alisal Arts Instagram page. For KCBX News, I'm Melissa Toledo.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.